Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we spend an hour with San Francisco State University's Project Censored Club students. We'll be looking at the recent stories that they have been researching for the next round of Top Censored Stories. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to be taking a deep dive into some validated independent news stories that are under consideration for the top 25 at Project Censored for our next book. Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and I are going through those stories right now, and on today's program, we'll highlight some key contributions for validated independent news from San Francisco State University students. The faculty advisor is Ken Burrows. Listeners to the Project Censored Show, of course, are familiar with Ken Burrows. He's been on our program numerous times as a guest and co-host. While Ken isn't with us today, we do have his students that have been researching stories for the latest round of validated independent news stories. Those are the stories that students and professors around the country research every year, looking for stories that have been underreported or missed by the corporate media, yet they've been covered in the independent and alternative press. They have been factually vetted. They have been researched on university library databases for corporate news coverage. Students write up these summaries and they write up their analysis of the research they find regarding media coverage. These are the stories, of course, that go on our annual ballot that is voted on by Project Censored faculty, students, and judges that ultimately are winnowed down to our top 25 stories. And we've been doing this since 1976. And these stories are currently under review for the Censored 2019 book that Andy Lee Roth and I are putting together right now. That book will actually be out in October. But right now, we get a sneak peek of some of these fantastic stories that are on the ballot. We are joined by Bethany Surface, who is co-president of the Project Censored Club at San Francisco State, and we have several other students that are going to come on and share their research with us. The first would be Malcolm Pinson. But before we get to Malcolm, who's on the phone from San Francisco State University, Bethany, you're in studio here. Tell us a little bit about what do you do at the Project Censored Club at San Francisco State. You're a veteran there, and you're actually on your way to graduating.
I'm graduating soon, so this is my fourth semester in the club on campus. And it started basically as like an assignment for one of my classes. And I basically have been doing it voluntarily ever since. And it's been fantastic. Getting a chance to look at these stories and these issues more in depth has been honestly one of the biggest learning experiences from my undergrad experience. Now that I'm looking back in it as I get ready to graduate. But basically what we do, we've got our weekly meetings, which are pretty awesome. We've hosted a handful of teaching events and things like that. And we've done these radio shows a few times in the past, usually about once a semester. Then it varies between like which students we get into. This semester, we've got a lot of visual arts students. So we're doing like a zine. We're doing political cartoons with our stories. And so each semester changes and forms to the student types that we get in.
And that's fantastic. And it also allows for diversity. You're actually able to sort of have your own unique local culture at the university where you are.
Exactly.
Right? And yeah. Project Censored works with about 20 different colleges and universities across the U.S. San Francisco State University, of course, one of the longest running of our affiliates with Ken Burrows. And Bethany, you've been on the program before. And so, too, has Malcolm Pinson. And Malcolm, you're on the phone. You've got two stories to talk to us about today. So why don't we just jump in here? One of the stories you have is J. Gabriel Ware. It's Meet the Man Bringing Cheap Renewable Energy to His Hometown. This is from Yes Magazine. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I did this one earlier. This one is basically about a guy named Ollie Duro, who created his own clean energy organization called the Riders Corporation Industry, I believe. And in that industry, he just spreads the awareness about clean energy and tries to make clean energy more obtainable in his hometown, because back in 2011, there's a $4 million unpaid light bill that happened in Michigan, which had at least 40% of their lights had to be repossessed. So there's like a lot of inequality in that area, which is a predominantly black area. So Ollie went and created the Riders Cooperative Industry, and he's just been spreading the awareness about clean energy and trying to make it happen in his hometown, which is really interesting.
And this has been going on since 2015, so this is a pretty good example of somebody in the community kind of taking proactive measures to do very productive things.
He's also been collaborating with other grassroots organizations, and they've been educating students going to schools and educating residents on solar energy and like the benefits of it, which I think is really interesting as well. Some of the projects that they've been working on are net zero energy homes. So they're homes that like use as much energy to create as an annual year. And there's solar power lawnmowers, solar power charging stations. So they're just really focusing on solar and trying to brand away from carbon.
And this is a really big story because it's also a very positive story of proactive or activist kind of responses to the challenges we face. And of course, one of the biggest challenges we face on the planet is the climate crisis.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this is one of those stories that says, hey, there are people that are taking matters into their own hands. They are building productive enterprises, and they're actually also trying to teach people how to live different ways, right? So this isn't just about addressing a problem and just fixing a problem, so to speak. It's also constructively working towards new ways of being and doing things.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that really drew me to the story, because it's one thing just to say, oh, I know this is the problem and we need to have clean energy. But when you actually have a solution and you're teaching people, I think that's what really makes the movement grow.
And so what have you taken away from researching this story?
Well, I just think that clean energy is here already, but people just need to start looking deeper into it and start reporting it and spreading the word about it, because it seems that so many people are so afraid of what's going to happen and are like always focused on how bad everything is when you just really need to like check out the positives that are going on in this world. And it could inspire more creators and more people to just think creatively about clean energy.
So, Malcolm, what you're saying in a nutshell is that it's possible.
Yeah, it's possible. A lot of people think it's impossible. But I mean, if you just really do some research, look into it, there's things that people are already trying to make differences.
Well, you sound pretty excited about the story, so you've probably been talking about it and telling other people about it and talking about it in classes.
A lot of people are really shocked when I tell them, like, yo, there's already solutions. Like, people are already actively working to fix this problem, because a lot of people don't know about it, and a lot of these type of stories aren't being reported in the mainstream news.
That's for sure. And you had one other story that you were researching. Could you talk a little bit about the other story that you've been looking at?
The other story I did was focused on gentrification, because I know that's a huge problem in the Bay Area and a lot of other big cities across the nation. And this one was actually in Philadelphia, and it was the mayor of just trying to work on solutions to gentrification. And there's another grassroots approach. I've noticed that most of my stories like cover the grassroots, because I feel like a lot of the change happens when the community wants to change. Like, it's different when one person just says we need to change, but if you could get the community involved, I feel like that's how it could really happen. So this one was just about a project that they did in Philadelphia and how they are planning to fight back against gentrification. There's a lot of open lots that weren't being used, and the community involvement was low. A lot of people didn't feel welcomed in their own community. So they reached out to the community members, and they just had people work in the community to fix their own community. So they would turn empty lots into gardens or recreational centers, rebuilding playgrounds as a community. And when people work together to fix their own community, there's some real change.
That's actually really good news, Malcolm. And I know that we've also had stories from San Francisco State in the past that talked about restorative justice in Philadelphia and some other things going on there. So it sounds like, once again, similar to the previous story, there's some collective action moving forward to improve people's quality of life.
Yeah, and then there's four tips that they had at the end of the article that could be used for other cities. The first tip is to experiment with the community. It says showing the community that they're trying. So like, if you're out there and you're experimenting and you're asking people for feedback and asking them like, what do they think is going to work? The community actually sees that you're trying to fix the problem, which is really important. Another one would be to identify tomorrow's leaders, because they're all grassroots organizations, people from the community. There's going to be leaders that step out that want to make change. Another one is just develop strong relationships with the communities, like through different classes and generations and races. If you could all get their trust, we could all see some change. And then the last tip that they had in the article was, don't underestimate the power of civic engagement. Kind of like how we were talking about earlier, word of mouth, just by talking to people and informing people about these issues. Word of mouth is really powerful. And if you get enough people talking about the topic, change will happen.
Especially when you're pointing out that these stories are sort of highlighting models, right? They're highlighting people that are modeling what the change looks like and inviting
exactly.
People to take part in it. So, Malcolm, anything else you'd like to add about any of the research you're doing right now, or is there anything you'd like to add about your experience also a veteran here now at the San Francisco State Project Censored Club.
I really enjoyed Project Censored. It's given me a lot of opportunities, you know, to be on radio. I'm a broadcasting major. There's a lot of cool people in here, too, and I learned about a lot of cool things that I would have never known about otherwise. And it's really important to analyze media because I wasn't taught to critically analyze media the same way in my broadcasting classes that I am in Project Censored, to, like, actually question them and, like, look for other sources. So that's definitely been eye-opening to me.
Well, Malcolm Pinson, that's certainly what Project Censored aims to do, is to fill those gaps and fill those voids on as many campuses as we can. And again, you know, you have one of the top 25 stories in the Censored 2018 book. We really appreciate all the work you're doing and look forward to the work you're going to be doing when you're into professional broadcasting.
We're also planning on doing a Project Censored podcast. Be on the lookout for that.
Thanks so much, Malcolm. Thanks for the work you're doing. Bethany, you can chime back in here for a minute. It sounds like the way you kick things off for us, the frame you set for us, Malcolm just demonstrated a lot of the things that you were already saying, and you're going to be working on possibly this podcast.
Yeah, Malcolm and I started Project Censored at the same time, and starting that podcast is something that he's been talking about for the last couple years. He's got a radio show now for one of his...
On campus?
On campus,
right on.
Yeah, KSFS, The Kickback on Thursdays at 7 to 8. He hosted us a couple weeks ago, but now he has the Digital Chopstick, do his own podcast, and so we just want to do, like, students of Project Censored, broadening the depths of these meaningful conversations that we have. Because, like he said, you know, like, none of our classes are really teaching us these skills to think critically about the types of media that we're taking in.
And it's fantastic, too, the way that Ken Burrows, who also runs the Holistic Health Center there, has a really great communal environment and a library that he's built up and a great place for everybody to hang out, sit around.
We have our meetings there.
And really talk about things, right? And I've been to a couple of the meetings, and, you know, it's really great to see people get in depth, go around the room, people really learning out loud, you know, not being afraid to think or ask questions. You mentioned the teach-in a couple times already. I just wanted to let listeners know that recently at San Francisco State, you all were involved in putting on a teach-in around the homeless crisis.
Yeah,
in the
and
Bay
mental
Area.
Health issues and how that those are both very closely tied to each other, even though the mainstream narrative is that when people are homeless, they just need to get a job or stop drinking alcohol. When in fact, alcohol and drugs is number 11 on the list of what causes homelessness. And so we really just need to take a more conscious look at it, more holistic approach. So that's what that teach-in was.
I saw some photos and heard a little feedback from it. It sounded like it was a great event. I know Charles Bethune was there and
he was fun.
With his great peace panels, and he'll actually be at the summit with us this fall.
Nice.
So a quick plug for that, folks. This October 26 and 7, Project Censored's Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy Education for Social Justice. Just figured I'd plant that in your heads. All are welcome. Students are free. It's going to be at College of Marin in the San Francisco Bay Area. You are listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, the host of the program here. Today, we are joined by students from San Francisco State University. You've been hearing from Bethany Surface, who is co-president of the Project Censored Club, along with Amber Yang, who couldn't be here today. We heard Malcolm Pinson on the phone. And when we come back from this musical break, we're going to hear from Jasmine Perez and Kari McKendall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we are joined by students from San Francisco State University, the Project Censored Club. We were joined earlier by Malcolm Pinson. Bethany Surface is here, co-president of the club. We're going to be hearing more from Bethany. We're also going to hear from Jasmine Perez. She's also here in studio, and she's going to talk about her experiences with the club as a new member. But right now, we have on the phone Kari McKendall. Kari, you did a few stories here for our latest batch of validated independent news stories. And one of the ones we were going to talk about here was the Pentagon loses track of $496 million in African operations, based on a piece by Nick Terse. It's kind of a follow-up from a previous story in a book that he had. So to launch us into that story, Kari, tell us a little bit, how did you come to get involved in the Project Censored Club? And then how did you get into this story?
I'm actually a part of an internship with Ken Burrows. He's actually and I was given a choice to be a part of different projects. And Project Censored was one that really called to me, and I always felt that getting news media out was extremely important and that people should know the truth.
And somehow you ended up researching this story. You ended up finding this story by Nick Terse about how the Pentagon sent $500 million abroad for international drug wars. How did you find this story, and then tell us about it?
I was searching on, I was on The Nation, actually, and I was just kind of scrolling through, like, looking around stories that I thought would be interesting for the club. And I've always been interested in the way the deep state kind of navigates through the world and, like, what they do and pretty much how they just, like, misuse our funds constantly. This one just caught my eye, considering that I didn't realize that we had so much money invested in Africa and African, I guess what they would say is counter-narcotic activities. That was the reason as to why that they were over there in the first place. And so I thought that was interesting. So I clicked on the story and that's how I found it.
And of course, this is a story that's been on Project Censored's radar, at least, even if the corporate media don't seem to get into it very deeply. We've had previous stories, in fact, just in the newest Censored book. Our second story was about how $6 trillion in unaccountable spending was happening through the Army. We've long covered issues of AFRICOM and sort of unearthing the actual things that are going on in Africa in terms of U.S. interests and, of course, tracking how much taxpayer money goes there. So, Kari, could you tell us maybe a little bit more about the story or anything you found particularly interesting about it once you started looking at it?
As I was reading it, I found something very interesting was that when the Inspector General tried to get the data around like how much money was spent and where it was spent, they ended up telling him that they had no idea. And that is extremely alarming in a way that they pretty much just told the investigator that they have no idea how much money was spent, what it was spent on, whether the projects were completed or not, or even if it made a difference in the fight against the illegal drug trade in Africa.
That's pretty remarkable in terms of no accountability, no transparency, no measurable outcome. And I know Nick Turse has written a lot about this kind of waste and unaccountability for a long time. And here he is again earlier this year publishing at The Nation, right? Sort of an update on this story. So it looks like you've unearthed some pretty serious issues, and including, of course, looking at how the U.S. military in terms of the African continent has grown drastically, and U.S. troops are now conducting 3,500 exercises, programs, and activities a year there.
It's kind of insane. Even they go a bit further. My story also talks about how in order for the money to actually be distributed, there had to be a special legalization. And pretty much that allowed the Pentagon and any of the troops to become partners with the DEA, FBI, any local law enforcement, customs, pretty much anyone that had a military reach, they could pretty much gain money from them and work with them. And that is even more disturbing that they're connected within these other agencies and they still don't know where the money's at. And so it's all kind of just seems like they're just trying to sweep it under the rug and they're trying to do a lot more with this money than they want us to know.
And Kari McKendall, right, stack that onto the fact that in the last election cycle, when some candidates, certainly not the two major candidates, but one was virtually blacked out and others that were also ignored, were bringing up the issue of how much money is spent on the military and how we could have things like Medicare for all or universal health care. Or how about something near and dear, not only to me as a professor, but to all of the students? How about free education?
It's really kind of crazy because people always talk about how, you know, America, oh, we don't have the money for this and we don't have the money for that, yet we are the richest country in the world and we don't have the money for these things.
We do, right?
Yes. We're just throwing it towards a military machine that really isn't going to stop soon unless we do something about it.
Well, Kari, that's a great story that you have submitted. It's a serious and important and ongoing one, including not just for what's in it, but for the things that we were just talking about afterwards, about what are our priorities. You know, if you go to the National Priorities Project, costofwar.com, and you start to look at how much money we throw into these wars and find out how much could we get if we put that money into the infrastructure, how many teachers could you hire, how many students could go to school for free. It's just absolutely mind-boggling, really. You have another interesting story that was at The Intercept. It's looking in, of course, to more revelations from the Edward Snowden files. This one's pretty gripping here. It's U.S. intelligence used pornography to break down Iraqi detainees. Tell us about that.
There was this team that was deployed to Iraq to lead kind of like a counterterrorism, counterintelligence mission. and they were seizing all of the computers and like the raids and stuff like that, and like understanding what was on these files and stuff like that. And they go in and they explain that they found pornographic videos, photos alongside thousands of audio files of the Quran and sermons as well, and recruitment and training CDs with videos of bombings, tortures, and beheadings. And they go on and jokingly refer the content as the three big P's, the porn, propaganda, and prayer.
The three big P's, porn, propaganda, and prayer. It sounds like a fitting subtitle for the Trump administration.
Yes.
So this is the NSA, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, right? These files were distributed to these organizations, right?
Yeah.
And so what was going on with this? What was the purpose of this?
It was interesting because what they were using it for is to, like, breaking down them or even in some ways supporting them. It was very interesting. They talked about how there were some who claimed that they were devout Muslims, but really, like, they had porn on their devices as well. And they use that to threaten them. Because I believe in their culture, being true to the faith is taken very seriously.
It reminds me of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, including people like Muhammad Atta, that was such a devout Muslim that he also had a great affinity for strip clubs, cocaine, and pork, and the rest of these kinds of things, right?
The story even goes on a little bit further, saying how they found pornography in Osama bin Laden's lair as well.
Right, and the purpose there, the alleged finding of this is, again, to tarnish the legacy and this kind of a thing, right? To try to get people to stop following these folks. Don't you think, however, that means that they might just start following somebody else?
They don't really think these kind of things through. I don't think they really understand the idea of like a solution-based kind of system. It seems like they just kind of want to keep perpetuating this until like the next stone, you know?
Yukari, I'm going to have to quote you on that. Quote, they really just don't think these things through. And based on the $500 million that the Pentagon couldn't find, they spend a lot of money on not really thinking these things through. What's your final takeaway on this story, do you think?
I find it so fascinating how much porn overlaps into other cultures as well, you know, because I know it is a big problem within our society, and then the way that they have just been using it, it's very interesting. And it's just like the layers that it's playing on is just so deep, and it's so embedded within our culture, us, who we are as species. It's just a very interesting topic. And so the fact that they are using it in such a disgusting way, I think, is really what sums it up.
Well, Kari McKendall, thanks so much for all of the work that you're doing at the Project Censored Club, San Francisco State University, with all of the students there, certainly with Ken Burroughs. And thanks for taking time to come on to the Project Censored show today to share your research with us. And, of course, it's an exciting time for us at Project Censored because Andy Lee Roth and I have the ballot compiled with all of the validated independent news stories that people like yourself and the good folks at San Francisco State. And we've got at least 13 colleges this year participating actively in the program with hundreds of students and faculty. So thanks again for your important contributions and research and sharing that with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today's program, we're looking at San Francisco State University's Project Censored Club and students and the research they're submitting for stories on our validated independent news story ballot. These are stories that are up for consideration, along with 150 or so others. That'll be part of the selection process for the next Top 25 that'll be coming out in Censored 2019 this coming October. After this musical break, we'll conclude today's broadcast. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been talking about new stories under review at Project Censored, and this is a fresh batch that the students at San Francisco State University have been working on this past semester with faculty advisor of the club, Ken Burrows. Before the break, we heard Bethany Surface. She's co-president of the Project Censored Club, finishing up her fourth semester in the club and graduating soon. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Last but surely not least, Jasmine Perez has been here hanging out with us in the studio. Jasmine, you're new to the Project Censored Club, right?
Yeah, I am.
You stumbled into it. How did it happen?
Basically, I got the option to choose between a few projects for the semester, and I was pretty interested in Project Censored and the whole idea of media literacy and really pushing that envelope.
One of the stories that you have here, reproductive justice versus the black anti-abortion movement. This looks like a deep dive into several overlapping subjects.
Yes.
And you have at least 5, 6, 7, 8 different independent sources that you're researching about this. And you co-researched this with Amber Yang, who isn't here today but has been on the program before. Tell us about this story. How did you stumble into this story?
I was scoping out an article on Yes Magazine's website, and it was just another link. It caught my eye, and so I checked it out. I read the article, and it was an independent experience from one individual, and I thought that just her story with it was really unique, you know, feeling like her bodily autonomy was just stripped away even when receiving medical care. And then that just, you know, it was diving deeper into the whole essence of what kind of rights you have as an African-American woman, as well as those disadvantages that you face.
There's part of this article here that talks about the use of shame in African-American communities aimed towards women by anti-abortion activists.
That's kind of a little tricky just because it comes from both sides, typically the anti-abortion movement as a whole, but also within the black community, which is where most of the shame is coming from.
Again, you looked at numerous sources on this, right?
Yeah.
You started out at Yes Magazine from a piece earlier this year. It's got something from Truth Out, a couple things from HuffPost, the Investigative Fund. What are maybe one or two other angles, or what are a couple of other things that you want to say about this or how you're processing this information?
I basically started branching out because I was trying to see if it was covered by any mainstream media. And that's when I started getting into Huffington Post and some New York Times things as well. But it was just brushing the surface of the anti-abortion movement rather than black anti-abortion movements and how that fits into reproductive justice. So it was quite a challenge to find that kind of support, and that's why the story is so layered, because it talks about anti-abortionists and it also talks about just the idea of a genocide for the black community and how it's not easy to get reproductive justice going when your own community isn't comfortable with it because of the systematic disadvantages.
And there's even some history here in terms of Margaret Sanger and the eugenics support, but also how that's kind of spun as it was a way of purposely eradicating blacks from communities and
right.
These kinds of things.
Yeah.
So there's a history. This goes back to the 20s.
It does, yeah. When you look into the history of gynecology, slavery, they did not have that choice.
Also, the access, right? I mean, and
yeah.
We've been backsliding from Roe v. Wade, right? You mentioned didn't have a choice, right? Referring to slavery, women not having a choice.
It does tie back into the shame that they are getting to choose. But the attack on Planned Parenthood is providing some services despite all that backlash, but it's also targeting the black communities because typically they don't have access to good quality health care. And they're not being educated on the other services or options that they have, and their experiences aren't being listened to.
And in some states, women have to travel hours to try to seek out services and things that they need.
Right.
Right. So this is a systemic assault on those kinds of choices, right? So, I mean, it's happening individually, locally, targeted communities, but it's also happening statewide in places
yeah.
like Texas, for example.
Definitely.
This is definitely one of the stories here that we have under review. We're excited to be looking at the ballot. This is certainly a story that is, I'm assuming, going to be attracting some attention. It's really well researched. And Jasmine, you're going to stay on with us for the rest of the segment, so feel free to chime in accordingly. And Bethany, let's go to you, Bethany Surface. You were on here talking about the club and some other things earlier, but of course you also are looking into some stories, right?
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us, given that you've been doing this for semesters now, what are a couple of the things that stood out to you?
I think this is the most stories I've ever submitted in one semester. I got four and a half. I helped co-write the big wireless one, which I'm grateful I got a chance to because that one was kind of mind-boggling when I read it.
That was the Nation article,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Maybe we can get into that one. Do you want to get into one of the other ones first?
Yeah, we'll do all three of them. One thing that's really stuck out to me is just, honestly, just looking at the corporate narrative around these issues that affect so many of us, is it kind of stuns me each time when I hear an issue or when I see something, and then I take a step back and look at the broader picture of how corporate interests kind of have shaped this narrative, how it's blatantly false, or you can see like, oh, this is who's benefiting from the regurgitation of this false information. And so I think just noticing that more and more has been the most eye-opening experience for me throughout all of this. And so when I find these stories, they just jump out to me based on who's profiting from this and who's suffering from it and who's losing those details in translation, you know, like how is corporate media playing a role in this? And so that's been like the three criteria that I look at when I see these stories, or even when I'm not writing stories, even when I'm just reading the news and staying informed.
Which is pretty significant because, pedagogically speaking, you're taking these intellectual skill sets with you, and they are now part and parcel of the way that you are looking at the world, mm-hmm. looking at news, analyzing stories, right? These types of things.
Yeah. So this is my last semester as an SF State student and also as an SF State Project Censored contributor. And so when you came to campus last month and we were all sitting around the depot, that was like one of the bigger meetings we had had. And there's a lot of new students and they're basically just like, how do you do it? And how do you take in all of this information? How do you, you know, find the time to do that? And it's like, it gets easier as it goes in a sense, you know, because the more you practice these skills, it just comes naturally, you know, and like your ability to just like question something, like prove it, who said, you know, like it just comes naturally. It's hard work at first. You know, the first handful of semesters, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, I got to get a story in for credit.
It's something that you're going to continue doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, these skills definitely don't end now. So that's been the general process. I'm really proud of the stories I have submitted, especially the ones this semester.
So one of your stories is on the Parkland shooter belonging to a group advocating marksmanship as a substitute for science education in the at Douglas High School in Florida. Tell us about that story.
That was another one of these umbrella stories in terms of the research that goes in. Like, I clicked on an article. Democracy Now! Had a two-part web series with Pat Elder. You know, I was listening to it, and I was just like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Like, I need to know more about this, especially coming from a small town where there's JROTC programs in every school. There's recruiting offices for every branch of the military. Like four or five a town. It's like Starbucks where I'm from, recruiting offices. There's Beale Air Force Base about 40 miles out of town. So when I read this story, I was just like, oh, wow. Like I actually kind of grew up in that culture. I want to see more, essentially. So Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz, he belonged to the junior ROTC program, which is basically an Army Reserve for high school students, which is funded by both the NRA and the Civilian Marksmanship Program. And that's the theme that my story takes because it really addresses like who is setting the infrastructure for this type of violence in schools. Nicholas Cruz was part of this program. And in Florida, not every state is this kind of lenient on what the JROTC program can substitute as like for curriculum. But in Florida, it can substitute as art, physical science, physical education, I believe econ and government. That's pretty ridiculous.
So you can sub out marksmanship shooting for any of these things, and it's considered a science credit.
For 4 years of JROTC curriculum, you can substitute essentially every other subject that you're required to learn in high school, and I just think that's astounding. As soon as I read that, I was just like, okay, well, I'm going to write this as a story because people need to know.
And the school itself was getting NRA money?
that's the tricky part with how the NRA funds these types of programs and how money actually gets into these school systems. So most of these high schools also have marksman shooting teams. Say a school has a soccer team, they also have a marksmanship team. And so the NRA gives grants to these marksmanship teams in forms of money or just equipment, which is the Army's kind of recycled guns. That's essentially how this whole scheme works. The Army gifts its old guns and ammunition to the Civilian Marksmanship Program, which is now a private entity, and then they just hand them out at will to programs that kind of buy into their ideology, and the NRA kind of helps fund them, and then also runs their media campaign. The NRA marketing is kind of ridiculous. There's this thing called NRA TV, and there's shows that are specifically cater towards children and towards housewives. It's like HGTV with guns. It's like the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And so this whole kind of picture of gun violence and how it is was actually created and how it's actually sustained in our country, I think corporate media is really missing the mark on that one.
Well, if the corporate media only could have journalistic marksmanship. You're mentioning here in the story about corporate media. Outside of the independent news sites and reporters who advocate change, corporate media talks about competitive shooting as a sport and praises it as such. Mm-hmm. And finished by saying, nowhere do they stop to talk about the societal ramifications of this culture this is creating.
Whenever I looked up anything that had to do with the Civilian Marksmanship Program, it was how they were giving grants to high schools and how these high school teams were basically winning awards. That was it. That's the only kind of corporate coverage of the Civilian Marksmanship Program.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been talking about new stories under review at Project Censored, and this is a fresh batch of validated and independent news that the students at San Francisco State University have been working on. We heard Bethany Surface. She's co-president of the Project Censored Club. And also, we are joined by Jasmine Perez. We heard from Jasmine earlier. And Jasmine, of course, if you want to chime in here in the final segment, please feel free to do that.
Yeah.
Bethany, you were looking, like you said, you looked at least four or five stories here, and you were a contributor on this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting story, and it's a topic we've certainly covered before. And it's certainly something that we've seen coming from students at San Francisco State as well. This is the story that was in The Nation. It's how Big Wireless made us think cell phones are safe while selling millions of them. Again, The Nation did a piece on this. Mark Hertzgard and Mark Dowie. Hertzgard from Snowden fame. We also have, of course, a physician's report, right? A Physicians for Safe Technology report.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bethany, launch us into this. What's going on in this story? This is a very long article in The Nation, by the way.
It was,
and there's a
yeah.
lot to it. And I remember sharing it with people on social media and saying, read the entire thing to the end, because each time you think you know where they're going, it goes somewhere deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So yeah. Tell us about that.
On this article, again, it was a super lengthy one, and I wrote it with one of our other newbies this semester, John.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of approached me asked me to kind of help him research it because it is a very dense topic, and it kind of jumped out at him. And I had written on this topic in the past, and last semester we hosted a teach-in kind of talking on like the perils of this type of technology and the push for 5G and how that's super invasive. For us as humans, like it's not healthy technology any way you spin it.
We did a show with Ken and others on the 5G.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And covered that. The student's name was John Michael Dulalis, I believe.
Yeah, right. That's it. That's the one.
Okay. So, well, again, given that you've looked into this for a while and some of the folks that are really big in this scene, we see Joel Moskowitz, we see several of the big players and people have been really on the front lines of kind of talking about some of the issues with this technology.
My biggest takeaway from the story was the wargaming on science that the wireless industry did through funding its own science, keeping the results and findings private, and then also funding like bad science. So they had kind of an argument on either side. So that was kind of the biggest takeaway in kind of how they pushed these types of devices and this type of wireless radiation on the public, or just kind of snuck it by, because these things don't really need any more advertisement in terms of how addicting they are. You can basically run your entire life off of it. Of course, everyone wants one with instant access. They looked into the science of all of this and basically how it had been hidden away from public sight, just same as how big tobacco did, and then the fossil fuel industry did as well, you know, the sugar industry. all of these big industries and things that are really, really bad for us, they fund their own science and then they keep it hidden away.
PR playbook for manufacturing doubt, right? Don't talk in great detail about potential dangers. Just talk about why it's convenient and why you need it for safety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the numerous layers of advertising and the psychological manipulation, right?
Yeah, and this, the fact that the intention was to addict the consumer to the product before they had all of the information as to how the product actually affects them biologically, mentally, emotionally, cognitively, all of this stuff. And so I think that was the most astounding thing, was just like the intention to addict the consumer and then basically hide the facts and the truth about these products so we can't really make our own informed decisions on them. I know, had these devices been tested before they were released to market and had all of the testing results and the science been released with them, I know a lot more people would not have been on board with these things, like not even a little bit.
And it was a fledgling industry, right? I mean, like, that's the history that this article in The Nation unearths. The so-called millennial digital native generation, right? The people that are growing up with it, you folks, you're growing up with this stuff. I did not grow up with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing it come into the culture was kind of, it was odd. It was kind of Wall Street-y, you know, elitist
kind of
affluence,
annoying.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of Star Trek-y. And then it started to try to turn it into something cool and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But again, some of the statistics were pretty interesting. When this stuff was first coming up about, like, well, what's going on with this? There's a lack of certainty about the safety, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1990s, it says here, 6 of every 100 people had a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And as of 2016, 95 out of 100 now use a cell phone. So obviously the PR worked, despite that we keep finding more and more and more that radiation is problematic. The WHO declared this a possible carcinogen in 2011. This isn't tinfoil hat stuff.
It's science.
It's actual science.
Yeah.
It's not being funded by big telecom, right? And of
Which
course, big telecom has a great lobbying arm and a legal arm that really tries to squash and suppress any public institutions that try to warn people about any potential dangers, right? And we saw even in Berkeley, California, they successfully were able to get passed through the city council, something that failed in San Francisco because of the telecom lobbies. But in Berkeley, they were able to get the warning on the outside of the box. It's simply the same warning that lives inside the instruction manual. In 2-point font that they blew up on the box and just said, hey, if your lawyers vetted this and agreed to this language that this is a problem and that you put it in the manual, it should go on the outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Big Telecom fought that tooth and nail because why? Well, that's a huge blow to the PR success that they've had, right?
It's funny that you mentioned that because I actually recently got a new cell phone around Christmas and I had to go into the store and talk to them, get a phone, whatever. And I was looking, they gave me the box and then they were doing something with my phone. So I opened the box and looked in the instruction manual and looked for the safety precautions, and nowhere in there did it say anything about safe exposure or anything like that from these things. And I asked the people at Sprint, I was just like, you know, what's up with this? What do you guys have to say about the electromagnetic radiation? Like, when they were just like, huh, what?
Yeah, they're not paid well, but they're at least paid enough to not talk about those things. These things are relatively ubiquitous. And they're, like you said earlier, they're at the cornerstone of people's lives, essentially.
Yeah.
So how that's been able to happen is pretty amazing. You know, as we go through that article at The Nation, they do cite numerous scientific credible sources that sound at least precautionary alarm bells, that talk about how the science is literally growing about some of these problems. And we have seen several countries around the world limit their use, limit Wi-Fi use
France
in schools.
Banning it in elementary schools.
Yeah. So, you know, again, precautionary principle. This isn't something that we don't see played up much at all in
Not
the corporate
even a
press.
Little bit. But yeah. Verizon will definitely, and, you know, all of these big telecom companies have the most, you know, creative and elaborate television ads just constantly, always.
This is why corporate media likely is not covering this.
Exactly.
Is telecom is a massive advertiser and sponsor of sports. You know, they're major advertisers on TV, newspapers, internet sites, all over the place. What's a takeaway that you maybe have from working on this article?
Really great story.
Well, it's definitely an in-depth story with a lot of history.
It's so difficult to boil down into a 400-word abstract, especially when it's such a deeply layered story. How do you get all of that in one?
It's a developed skill, right?
I mean, yourself,
the story, Jasmine, that you did was a very in-depth, detailed, complex, multi-sourced piece.
Yeah.
It's a real skill to be able to, I mean, you really have to have read the articles and thought about the issue in order to distill it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to go and do all the media work on it. Like, well, okay, well, where is this covered? And if someone is covering it, how are they covering it?
Yeah.
Right. So those are pretty detailed. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, also exposes the nature of censorship in a free press system. Right. It's multifaceted. It's not necessarily the story you never heard of. It's the story maybe you hear a lot about, but there is five or six things about it that you never hear.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So one issue.
You get the impression that it's being covered, mm-hmm. but there's a very serious underside that is routinely ignored.
Definitely.
Or kicked aside.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more important points that we reached this semester with our club is like, if it's been covered in corporate media, throw it out. You can't look at it. And it's like, no, like, how has it been covered? You
right.
know, like, what are they saying about it? Even though it's covered, it still technically can be censored.
Right, because censorship is anything that interferes with the free flow of information
yeah.
in a society that purports to have free press systems. And if the New York Times covers these kinds of stories, we can see that now going on in places like Syria. I don't want to open up that can of worms, but Syria is being – yeah, another hour. I mean, it's being covered all over the place, but there's all
the
kinds of –
behind Syria, not even
yeah,
a little bit. Yeah.
Good luck finding it in the fog of war, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another example.
The gas.
So, Bethany, another one of the stories you're looking at, and this has been a huge theme for us, of course, at the project, because we've been looking at the problems of fake news for 40 years, but it certainly has been popularized and gone off leash, and there's a lot of different ways to define and look at it. And one of the stories that you also are looking at is from the Chronicle of Higher Education, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some real data on fake news. Just figured this is a good way to go out of the show because, you know, it looks like here they're narrowly trying to look at the issue of fake news. And at the project, we've really broadly looked at the problem of fake news as mm-hmm. propaganda, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we now know that it's a weaponized term and it refers to certain things, right? So can you tell us a little bit about some of this article that you were looking at?
Yeah, so this article, it basically covered two separate kind of studies. One was covered in the Chronicle of Higher Education and the other, I believe, in PC World.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so they took like a narrow kind of view on fake news. And I just want to make clear that in this context, fake news is defined as like blatantly false information, not, you know, like.
Right. Hoax information.
Yeah.
Purposely false.
Yeah. It's
right.
just straight up like blatantly false information. And the first study, this guy, Gus, I believe his last name is Gus. He analyzed computer traffic, web traffic on 25 willing participants. I want to make that they were willing when they were mm-hmm. giving up this computer data.
It was Andrew Guess is the Guess. Assistant professor of politics and
yeah.
public affairs at Princeton University. I just wanted to point, in case anybody wants
yeah.
to look that up,
look
right?
Up.
They can
yeah.
they can find that. They can also find the VINs, the Validated Independent News Source at projectcensor.org. So go back to telling us about these willing participants.
So they 2,500 willing participants basically kind of gave up their computers or handed over their computer traffic for 2 weeks before the 2016 election and 2 weeks after. What he found a couple really kind of notable statistics on just how this false information kind of travels and gets disseminated through things like Facebook.
Yeah, social media definitely
yeah,
a vehicle for this.
Yeah. And basically the first one was like 10% of 60% of the fake news content that he found or 10% of the people were responsible for 60% of the fake news. So it's a very kind of like small and limited faction of these people that were just kind of like ridiculously reposting or retweeting or whatever you do, fake information. And so after him and his team kind of looked further into these details, they found two trends. Overall, just on the data that they analyzed, basically of like who is most susceptible to this type of fake news. The first one was just a low level of media literacy, basically just not kind of knowing what's coming at them. So they're just re-clicking and retweeting away. They don't really have the skills like Jasmine and I and Kari and Malcolm were talking about of like really digging deep into these articles. They just kind of see it at face value and, you know, mm-hmm. clickbait.
Well, no critical media literacy, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They're accepting things at face value.
Mm-hmm.
We've long said that the antidote to this isn't algorithms, isn't censorship, isn't blacklisting. It's teaching people when they're younger how to actually go through this.
Exactly.
Stuff, right? Then
yeah.
You're in the driver's seat, right?
Definitely. I think even another trend is when you find, you know, when you're trying to research and you understand that you need to go deeper into your sources, like one thing with my story was it was so hard to find, you know, statistics that did support it or statistics at all. A lot of them are just very mm-hmm. controversial, and you try to get into who's reporting them, or, you know, they're underreported or just not reported at all.
Right. And Bethany, what's the other faction? You had the one faction that's sort of the people that aren't really thinking critically or don't necessarily seem to exercise the tools to think about these things more deeply. And the other
one was being a Trump supporter. I know it seems a little bit kind of like biased or whatever, but most of the fake news was pro-Trump. And so that was the two main like statistics that they took away was low-level media literacy and then just being on the pro-Trump side. I guess there's just a lot more false information.
I've looked into this story because I actually had some qualms about some of the claims. I would at least try to back out of, as you pointed out, right, instead of it as being this is a Trump thing, as what this is what they claim the statistics are suggesting.
Yeah.
But I have been looking into this and suggesting more that it seems to be hyper-partisan ideologues, right?
Mm-hmm.
People that are just kind of dyed-in-the-wool confirmation bias, right?
Like
motivated
crazy.
Reasoning, inferred justification, groupthink, hive mind, I'm with her,
or
make America great again, right? It seems like that kind of slavish idolatry of demagoguery is what propels some of this problem.
Absolutely, yeah. And then that kind of leads right into the second study that this story talked about. This guy, he wanted to see the way that Facebook's algorithms kind of acted on their own when human behavior was kind of like taken out of the mix. Just to see like how Facebook suggests posts, because his thinking was most people, at least up until recently, got their news and their content on Facebook. And so he wanted to see how Facebook kind of reinforces the views and, you know, of the user, like how, so if I say like I'm pro this or pro that, how does Facebook's algorithm then back that up and just flood me with things that I want to see mm-hmm. as opposed to like what's actually out there? And so basically this guy, he set up two profiles. One was a Trump supporter. One was a Clinton supporter. He liked three pages on both and then did absolutely nothing and just wanted to see the types of posts and pages that Facebook recommended. So after he set up these two anonymous pages, he then liked 10 of the suggested pages on both sides. And he did it in like a systematic fashion. It was like the first, fourth, seventh, and 10th pages, and then like the first, second, and third. And so altogether, he had 10 pages that he had liked based off of Facebook's suggestions after the initial three kind of people that he liked. So he set up a very clear Clinton supporter and a very clear Trump supporter in 2 days. It took 2 days. He just kind of let Facebook do its work its magic, if you will.
Its magic. The magic propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. And after 2 days, he checked back just to see what was in both of these people's feeds. And he came away with four kind of notable statistics.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was that all of the fake news here, again, defined as like false information. Mm-hmm. He found 10 posts all in the Trump supporters' feeds, none in the Clintons. That's not really to say like Clinton supporters are better than Trump's. That's just the fact.
That's what they found in the study.
That's just, based on after 2 days, that's just what they found. The second one is that the Trump supporter saw nearly three times as many posts as the Clinton supporter. And so I think that just says something to the amount of like just kind of propaganda when it's just streaming past you. It gets harder and harder to kind of differentiate what's true and what's not. And it gets easier to get stuck in like that silo of like confirmation bias.
Hey, that's a real problem, the silo of confirmation bias. And it's certainly something we teach a lot about in critical media literacy, right? It's something that you have to be aware of in your own, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What are my biases? What are my blind spots? What am I looking for? And how do I learn how to better research outside of those to find out empirically what might really be going on?
Exactly.
Right. Well, certainly at Project Censored, that's part of the research that we try to push people to do. And we expand the definitions of censorship and certainly fake news, because a lot of the stories we see coming through corporate media are partially true,
mm-hmm.
right? Or partially true without context,
right? Yeah.
And so those things can be quite insidious, mm-hmm. perhaps even more so than totally fake stories.
Yeah.
Because something that's totally fake could actually be looked up and corroborated.
Exactly.
Something that's partially missing is often harder to find because people may be lulled into believing they're getting the whole story at the New York Times, mm-hmm. right, or the Washington Post. Even though that those two cases where those are newspapers that do journalism, right, they sometimes also are obviously doing very biased or establishment kinds of journalism,
yeah.
which is propaganda.
Yeah. And that was actually one of the last kind of things that he found. One of the third and fourth main statistics that he found was like most of the content wasn't like partisan. It was neither true nor false. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like blatantly partisan. It was somewhere in the middle. It was like barely on the edge, kind of. Just basically like reinforcing the overall theme.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like you were saying, it's not 100% false. It's not 100% true. It's somewhere in the middle. So it's not really like a fact of information. It's more like an opinion kind of thrown in between all of these like false information, posts and tweets and things like that. And so, yeah, that was, one of the things they found was just like the, majority of posts that people read are neither slanted one way or the other, but they basically just serve to reinforce the theme that's already in the algorithm, that's already in your feed. And so again, it just kind of reinforces the ideology of the person who signed in at that point. And I just think that's a really dangerous thing. And obviously we're seeing how they're getting these algorithms with our data.
Yeah, and it's certainly something that we need to be talking a lot more about as we move forward.
Absolutely. So,
Bethany Surface, thanks so much for joining us for the entire program today.
Jasmine Chris,
thanks so much for joining us as well.
Of course.
Thanks to everyone at San Francisco State University's Project Censored Club and your co-president, Amber Yang, also the faculty advisor, Ken Burrows, everyone else there. I had a great time down there when I came to visit and do a talk there this spring. It's always fun to go down every semester. And again, great students, great work. We're honored to be working with people there. And we're really excited about the ballot process, and we're looking forward to seeing which stories go forward.
Us as well.
Right? Yeah. So that'll be happening here coming up in the next month. So that does it for the segment today. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund.
That does it for another episode of The Project Censored Show. I'm host and executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Today's program was produced at KPCA in Petaluma by Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. All of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.